Welcome to Energy Talks, a regular podcast series with expert discussions on topics related to power system testing, data management, and cybersecurity in the power industry. My name is Scott Williams from the podcast team at Omicron, and I will be your host. Hello, everyone. In this episode, which is part 8 of our mini-series called Cybersecurity and the Power Grid, we investigate hardware cybersecurity. We will explore why not only software, but also hardware devices need to be secured against cyber threats. My guest is Omicron hardware developer Marcel Strohla. He describes how hardware cybersecurity is crucial because it is another potential attack vector that can be easily neglected. Marcel will share his experiences and challenges with hardware cybersecurity and describe the innovative hardware technology used to develop Omicron cybersecurity solutions. He will highlight how important proper cybersecurity for your hardware applications is and offers tips to ensure it. Hi, Marcel. Thank you for joining me for this Energy Talks episode about cybersecurity hardware.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this chat.
Marcel, tell us a little bit about yourself. For the last couple of years, I understand you've been responsible for developing a new mobile Omicron platform called MBX2. Could you describe this new mobile platform and what inspired you to become a hardware developer at Omicron?
So about our new MBX2, it's mostly meant as a refreshing update for the MBX platform as a whole, since we could do a lot with the new components that are available now. And we've collected some experience with customers and ideas that we could implement.
Mm-hmm.
And about myself, I've always liked puzzles. And I've been taking technical things apart to look inside since I was small, like a 4-year-old taking apart the radio, that kind of thing.
Sure.
We have a good electronics school nearby as well, so it was an easy choice to go that route in my education. As for why Omicron specifically, well, I have a friend here. He's still working here like 15 years now, and he's always been going on and on about how great of a place it is to work. So obviously I had to apply eventually, and that's how we ended up here. Lastly, I've been to computers as well since I was a teenager. I built my own every now and again, and I usually invest time to tweak the settings, tune the voltages, overclock it as much as I can to just get the most out of it. So I have a good idea of what's going on in there, and I also like to keep up with the news and everything to know what's good at any point in time. So ultimately, it was a really good fit for me to handle the MBX refresh since it's basically an industrial PC, very customized. We have our CPU module and our custom motherboard, and everything is designed to our specifications.
Okay. Let us dive right in then, Marcel. Many people think of cybersecurity solely in terms of software. Why should we also be concerned about the security of hardware components?
Because hardware is what everything builds on. As the lowest layer, every opening it provides will interface with something critical, like the drivers, the kernel. Let's say you have a serial interface that was never properly disabled. Suddenly you have root access and nobody knew it because it was just an oversight that it was still left active in development. Speaking of the interface, connectivity is becoming increasingly important. So a typical computer now provides multiple interfaces, wireless, wired, and they might not even be obvious to the user. Like you have Bluetooth, you have your Wi-Fi, and on the wired side, you have even more different kinds, low-level, USB, Ethernet, and various PCI Express, whatever. So like I mentioned earlier, it's easy to miss one of them, and it just takes somebody with a bit of electronics knowledge to access it. The design itself is also getting increasingly complex because things are progressing, everything is getting more transistors and getting more complicated and powerful, of course. So even for relatively small things, you get large documents where they document every little thing that goes wrong if you do this or that, because some of these flaws are just in the hardware. So they need to document it and work around it with the software component.
Mm-hmm.
And for the higher end, CPUs even try to predict what's going on and what calculations they might need to speed up things, which has led to exploits of their own, like Spectre, you might have heard, Meltdown, even something related to Spectre was just disclosed last week, I think. So they're still ongoing that they find things that are related to this complexity in modern hardware. Even the actual silicon can be manipulated. Like in the memory, you have rows of data. And if you use the patterns a certain way, you can even manipulate the content.
Okay.
It's, some of these are a bit more research and lab situations than real life exploits, but they're still there. And it might be that they can be used at some point. So what it comes down to really is the physics of it all, since we understand so much more these days. Like, you might not think much of it, but you have your wireless keyboard and it just automatically communicates with your computer. But unless that is somehow obfuscated, it just might send us keystrokes, and anybody with an oscilloscope might be able to decode it. And going beyond the communication of the keyboard to the computer, even the sound these days can be analyzed to indicate where the key on the keyboard was pressed, because the sound resonance is all that slight bit different. Yeah, if you have high enough resolution, apparently these days you can just eye analyze it, as they say, and decode a password or some such.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Another wild one is that, you know, everything has a microphone these days on your smartphone, on your smart speaker at home. And these are tiny integrated circuits. They are MEMS circuits, which means micro electromechanical systems that can actually be manipulated by light. So if you shine a laser on it, you can make it think that it's hearing sound. So you can use a laser with the right pulsing to trick a smart speaker into listening to a command that is not really happening.
Oh, this is scary.
Yeah, you can sit outside the window in somebody's house and tell it to open the garage. If it's configured to do that, then you just got in there.
So there's so many ways to get into a system that it's hard to really think of all of them.
Yeah, that's a big challenge, to keep track of everything and to get the overview that you need to really verify that something is safe. But furthermore, the abilities to attack something have also been increasing with the pace of technology. About 10 years ago, you could buy a USB stick that could be maliciously configured to simulate the keyboard and insert keystrokes, so you can take over a system if you find somebody, if the user that plugs it in has the right access. These days, it's gone even further, thanks to miniaturization, that it's a whole cable now that works normally, so you would never notice. It could just be swapped out by somebody having access, or if you find it lying around, or it might be in your drawer and you need a new one, you just pull it out. Somebody deposited it there. And it's just a normal cable. But as soon as somebody wirelessly sends the command, since it has its own Wi-Fi hotspot, it can become active and start a takeover or other malicious behavior.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Tell me something. This is maybe naive of me to ask. Why are people so desperate to get into systems?
We are in the information age, so any power you have over information is very useful. And I don't think anybody is desperate to particularly get into my email, for example, or anything else. But all in all, it's a very easy way to come to some gains, whether they are legitimate or not. And especially when you get to the world stage and politics and everything, it's quite powerful to be able to influence things in an unseen way, or just exert more influence than you would have otherwise. Like, for example, I heard a fun fact, in quote marks, about North Korea, that something like half of their assets are crypto-based these days, and just through internet exploitation, they make a lot of money, since they have trained hackers. They have some internet access and they use it to help the country with funding.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there's a lot of power in exploiting any access that you might come across. There's also another layer to it, since people know that this is a thing. You can, even if you don't have access, you can still use it to tell somebody that you recorded them on their webcam and you have private videos that you're releasing to their friends and family. So they should pay you like $1,000. And if it works in 1 in 10,000 and you send it to a few 100,000 people, that's good, a good chunk of money.
So that explains the effort.
Yeah. to circle back to your central question, hardware cybersecurity is crucial because it's yet another attack vector that can be easy to neglect and miss. For starters, is your access restricted to the hardware? Is the hardware itself secure? Do you trust everyone that can access it? Like, if you have handymen in the area that are supposed to fix something, do you know who it is? Do you check that they're not doing anything malicious to whatever computers may be nearby? There's a lot of complexity very quickly that we tend to overlook.
So Marcel, can you walk our listeners through a few real-life scenarios to illustrate the importance of hardware cybersecurity? For example, can you tell us about incidents where compromised hardware led to disastrous consequences?
One certainly comes to mind that many people might have heard of in this field, Stuxnet, that was used to severely damage Iranian efforts to enrich nuclear material. So as the story goes, an employee came upon a USB stick in the parking lot one day, didn't think much about it in those times. That was like 2010 or something. And he went on into plug it into his computer to see what might be on there and if it's of any use. However, unbeknownst to him, it used several unknown exploits at that time to get into the system. And from there, it was using the control system of the enrichment centrifuges to program the hardware in a way that caused it to fail and destroy itself, basically. It's been a while now. It's ancient history, basically. Yeah, it's a very good example of something that created awareness, because in those times, you didn't think much about a USB stick, right?
Sure.
And that's certainly something that system designers need to think about. So if your employees have access, they also need to be aware of consequences that come with it, like using devices that they don't know.
And sure.
Potentially also software they don't know, but that's not what we're talking about today, right? So what that shows is that the whole process needs to be looked at. In this aforementioned example, the whole system was cut off from the outside, I imagine. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have internet access. But inside, I would imagine it was relatively free for all, that employees who were in the building and were able to access the network apparently also could find the control software that was used in this attack. And that's what this worm exploited.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, it should also have been more restricted in that way, that employees are allowed to do certain things, but not get to the most critical part of the infrastructure quite as easily.
Sure.
And speaking of programming hardware, that's one thing we need to clarify. What do we even mean when we talk about hardware and software? You noticed it earlier where I keep mentioning software because it's the whole thing that we need to look at.
Sure.
One. And also, there's a huge gray zone between hardware and software, because if you go beyond basic logic gates, there's always some programming involved, some firmware, some software in most any chip that has noteworthy complexity.
Marcel, how do experts approach this differentiation? Adding another layer of complexity, there's also the aspect of firmware, correct?
Yeah.
And could you elaborate on when we specifically refer to firmware and when we refer to software?
Yeah, sure. So like I said, it's a gradient. It starts with application-specific chips that are, strictly speaking, hardware, mm-hmm. but they are created by programming chips in a certain way and then fixing the hardware, basically. So you're just producing the chips. You don't have to program them anymore. It's just everything is fixed. But that also means that any software bugs that were in there in the original implementation will also be fixed in there. Mm-hmm. So it's hardware, but it kind of has a software bug, if you want to look at it that way. Or programming, whatever vocabulary you want to use exactly.
Okay. And so would all of that be found on the hardware chip?
Yeah, that is a specific chip that is supposed to implement certain functions. Like it might be a light controller where at home you have a light bulb, you have a small infrared remote or something, and switches through different colors. Those are typically, it might be ASICs, because ASICs as an application-specific IC, integrated mm-hmm. circuit, because they are cheap to produce. Once you have your functionality hashed out, you just produce the chips, and they're fairly simple usually, but the functionality has to be defined first, so if you have a certain complexity, that's also where you might introduce some bug.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're super efficient and fast, but that software kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
After that, there are microcontrollers and related chips like field programmable gate arrays, FPGAs, that are hardware adjacent, but they use firmware to define their function.
Okay.
Firmware in this context and generally, I would say, means that it's attached to a specific chip. Like mm-hmm. you have the processor and it itself has the memory on board that defines functionality. If everything's one piece and it's not supposed to be changing regularly, so we usually refer to it as firmware. And software is anything that is not specifically attached to a chip that might be on a hard disk or a solid state drive these days. And it's used to run from the CPU. Basically, the CPU executes code and boots the operating system. And all of that is software because it's not attached to the CPU as such. You could take the hard drive, put it in a different computer, and it would work mostly the same.
Okay.
That's the layman's distinction, I guess.
Very good. Well, thank you for that. So all in all, it sounds as if hardware vulnerabilities need to be taken seriously since they can affect industries and individuals. What steps can companies take to mitigate these risks? Marcel, who better than you to inform us about them? So especially considering your significant involvement in the development of our newest hardware edition, MBX2, could you comment on that?
Yeah, there's a whole list of things that need to be implemented correctly. There's a chain, if you will, that needs to be looked at, and every step needs to work. It's like a chain of dominoes. If one is missing, then it fails.
Okay.
It starts even outside the company. Before you even get the device, you need to make sure you trust your supply chain. There are factors that will help, like using a trusted platform module, so you can verify that only your own software will run that is signed with your own private keys. But ultimately, if somebody has enough resources and motivation, it's a very possible way to introduce security vulnerabilities if they can get into your supply chain. Of course, the hardware is next. So I use the recently developed MBX2 since that's the one I have the most experience with. We use components from vendors with a good reputation. We have a proven track record when it comes to vulnerability management, that they are published their disclosures on time and have fixes in place and all that. For example, we actually worked with Intel over the past few months to analyze and fix an issue with oversized packets in the Ethernet driver. This would lead to the kernel hanging and the whole system becomes unresponsive, but it's fixed in the latest kernel now.
Okay.
Aside from that, the hardware itself, you choose the components wisely, like error-correcting memory, and make sure everything has good margins for stability, be it in computing performance or electronically, that small power fluctuations don't cause it to freeze or even reset.
Why develop a new device, then? What are the largest challenges and what's new?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, we collected a lot of feedback in the years over the years. I think MBX1 came out in 2018 or so, maybe 19. And of course, that's a long time in computer hardware. So for one, the hardware also progressed to become faster and more efficient. And we've also had some inputs from customers over the years that we could bring in. For example, we now have modular SFP ports for the station connection, where you can either plug in an RJ45 connector or use the fiber optical connections. You can get these adapters in any configuration for any wavelength using just one fiber or two. So it's complete flexibility for the user, especially if you use the device and go to different customer substations as a service provider. You can have the configuration that you need at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a few different modules plugged in for what you need regularly. It's really nicely flexible.
Okay.
Another thing is also the improved performance from the new components. We have a much faster hard disk, we have much faster processor, we have more RAM. So it means it runs Station Guard as well, very well. And we also facilitate that by implementing the option of being able to mount it on a DIN rail. So you pop the side off and you screw in the clip that is supposed to go on the DIN rail, and that's it.
Okay. Very good.
I believe you mentioned the largest challenges. For one, certainly the housing, because between the CPU module and the feature request of having the SFP modules, which are fairly long, we really had almost no space to spare in the existing size of the NBX1, which we wanted to keep. We managed it by picking the right components that were just giving us the last few millimeters that we needed. Other than that, going through all the testing and certifications, we have environmental tests that are running for weeks to make sure it's working perfectly in high humidity, in high heat, combinations of those, changes of those, like going from cold to hot and vice versa. And of course, the certifications and registrations in the different countries that we can import it legally, that we can list the different standards in the manual, that we have this, that we follow all those EMC regulations just to verify it. It's a lot of work and effort.
Sure. So you're really trying to stay on top of things the whole time, not only about your continued development, but also the development of the components that you need and all other types of standards that are influencing the process. Is that correct?
Yeah. We have a few industry-relevant standards that customers like to be able to reference. Like if they pick a new device, they want IEC something or another, and they know it will fulfill their requirements and not get in the way of anything else.
Okay. So, Marcel, you mentioned that the MBX is designed to withstand sophisticated attacks. Could you give our listeners some insights into how it achieves this level of security?
Yeah. On the hardware side, we looked at all the things I mentioned earlier, like available interfaces. We make sure it's disabled in the BIOS if it's not used. Like, I don't know if all the jargon will mean something to people, but I2C interface, SPI, serial interfaces, all of that is present on the CPU and in the CPU module for debugging purposes or also for interfacing actual components that you might use. Mm-hmm. For example, in your laptop, I'm sure you have some I2C stuff that is used for low-level stuff like making LEDs blink. And all of that we have a look at, and if we don't need it, it gets disabled. Other than looking at the interfaces, we choose the right components, like industrial-grade CPU, error-checking memory. Our system disk has power fail protection, or power loss protection, sorry. That's what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we have to stay up to date on security updates relevant to the components that we have.
Okay, considering the future of hardware cybersecurity, looking at the broader landscape, Marcel, what trends and technologies are shaping the future of hardware security, and how can organizations stay ahead of the curve?
One thing that seems to be coming up or will come up at some point is quantum computing. I think a lot of people are researching what it means for our security and how we can even have secure communication in a future where quantum computing exists and is also more ubiquitous than maybe it is now as it is in an experimental stage. That's one thing that will certainly come up.
Again, just to clarify a term, quantum computing is something that we hear about. Could you describe what that means?
Not in too much detail. It's a new paradigm in computing where it uses quantum effects to do many more calculations in parallel, staying ahead of the curve. Basically, look at your implementation of security, look at what's going on, make sure your vulnerability management is up to date.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that can really help with all of that is secure crypto processors in your infrastructure. For example, these days, to get low-level access to our devices, we have to generate a certificate that is valid for a limited amount of time and is unique to every device. And without having the crypto processor in our server farm, we couldn't do this. We would just have a password or an SSH key or something. So it's really making the security thing a lot more dynamic. And if you wanted to hack a device or access it in a way that the developers can, you would have to get into that crypto system and know how to generate that certificate.
Interesting. Okay. So as we wrap up our conversation, Marcel, what key takeaway or message would you like our listeners to remember about the critical role of hardware cybersecurity?
Yeah, the most important thing, I think, is that you don't focus too much on one specific thing, like hardware cybersecurity, software cybersecurity, anything in between. The whole chain is important, from physical access to the hardware itself to firmware and software that runs on it.
Okay.
Another thing I would say is that you should try to be consistent in your security principles. Like if you have two-factor authentication for your software and all the complicated stuff, don't leave your computers unlocked. And make sure you trust your supply chain, as mentioned before. Another thing that can really help to make sure things are nailed down is getting a third party involved. For example, we worked with German Federal Office for Cybersecurity to certify RBX1. I believe that was even specific to version 2.something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's even specific to our software version. They don't guarantee that the next version will be fine. But we did it at that point, so we know we're on a good way there.
Well, thank you, Marcel, for joining me for this episode of Energy Talks and sharing your expertise and insights on the vital topic of hardware cybersecurity. It has been an enlightening discussion, definitely interesting for me and hopefully our listeners too.
Thank you, Scott. I really enjoyed our talk, and I have some last piece of advice for all the listeners. Stay vigilant, stay secure, and keep those firewalls up.
Good points to remember. Thank you, Marcel.
Thank you.
And a big thank you to our audience for listening to this episode of Energy Talks. We always welcome your questions and feedback. Simply send us an email to podcast@omicronenergy.com. Omicron has several years of experience in power system testing, data management, and cybersecurity in the power industry, and offers you the matching solution for your application. For more information, be sure to visit our website at omicronenergy.com. Please join us to listen to the next episode of Energy Talks. Goodbye for now, everyone.